So my guest today is Jane Darter, outgoing Chief Human Capital Officer at NASA. In recent years, Jane has been responsible for building the quality and depth of talent necessary for supporting NASA's mission, improving capabilities for delivering out-of-this-world human resource services, and positively shaping NASA's culture to maintain high levels of employee engagement and commitment. She embraces that we are people leaders in the people business, which guides her oversight of NASA's human capital policies, practices, and operations. Prior as the Deputy Assistant Administrator, she successfully managed numerous complex change initiatives, including workforce planning and analytics, learning and development, talent acquisition, and policy and accountability. One of her most rewarding achievements has been overseeing the transformation of decentralized human capital services across 10 centers to a centralized, functionally unified line of business. Jane is a member of the Office of Personnel Management's Chief Human Capital Officers Council and is known across the federal government for her work, often sharing her perspective and expertise with leaders and aspiring human capital professionals across industry and federal agencies. Please join me in welcoming Jane Darter. So, Jane, a huge and very warm congratulations on, you know, an incredible career. As you reflect on your time in HR, what do you see as your sort of two or three career highlights?
Well, first of all, thank you, Nick, for your congratulations. And I would say that though I've been in HR for a number of decades, probably the Chico role and what it had in it represent the highlights of my career. There are a couple of things that really stick out. I became the Chico maybe a month, 6 weeks before COVID became a household name. And so helping the agency move through that experience. None of us had a playbook, so we had to figure out what we needed to do. And we aligned very quickly around our values of safety and connection with our workforce. And I was really proud to be part of that effort at NASA. I also was instrumental in bringing about a consolidation of HR services from a decentralized version of how it worked across our field centers to a consolidated version. And we have, I think, come a long way. There's still more work to do, but I feel like we've realized a number of the benefits that we expected to get from this consolidation, and it set us up for the future. And last, but certainly not least, I really worked to build a workforce planning practice at the enterprise level, both before I became Chico and when I was Chico. That is, it was initially a decentralized activity at our agency, and I think we moved it to a really robust enterprise function, which continues to mature and develop. So those are some of my highlights.
Fantastic. And what were the impacts of the consolidation? What did you see sort of post that activity, both from an HR point of view and a workforce planning point of view?
So I would say that the enterprise view allows us to build things that wouldn't be built if we were in the decentralized model, which is more locally focused. And particularly now that we're in sort of a future of work reality where geography is less important to how and where work gets done than it was before, you know, the value of the enterprise is enormous. So we created an enterprise function in human capital that sets us up to be able to standardize some of the service offerings that we know that we can automate, for example, which would be hard to do in a decentralized environment, so that we can then pivot and focus on those things that really matter from the people delivery service. This happens locally and at an enterprise level. From a workforce planning point of view, I'd say, you know, that a lot of what the agency is facing, and I would say this would be true of any organization that's in a similar circumstance, that the more environmental changes that there are upon you, the more you need to look at things from an enterprise perspective. So that really requires you to have sort of a function in HR and elsewhere in the organization to be able to really draw together the information from across the enterprise and figure out how the entire organization can respond and take advantage of opportunities.
Is there a point from within your career where you've identified the whole people analytics piece and workforce planning piece really kicking in, so to speak, or taking hold?
Sure. I would say, if I start with workforce planning, I'd say that the first time that I observed our agency really taking advantage of what I would call more of a strategic workforce planning approach is when the space shuttle program came to its conclusion. And then there were other programs that came in, the Constellation program, and then finally settling on the programs that we now have, SLS Orion. And that was an example of a change in our demand or requirements that really went well beyond an individual organization or center, and it was really enterprise-wide. And it required a big shift of how we think about the distribution of work and workforce across the agency. So I think that we are at a place now with the agency where we are coming to some more bigger shifts in human spaceflight, but perhaps everywhere due to a combination of things like technology improvements and a number of opportunities and challenges that all federal government agencies face. So it's going to require us one more time to really think about how we leverage the whole. So I would say from a workforce planning point of view, this sort of strategic workforce planning, which I define as being for sure across an enterprise and also looking out a little further into the horizon, that's been coming in waves over the last couple of decades. From a people analytics point of view, I feel like we've gotten, and so have most organizations, if you read articles and listen carefully, there's a lot going on. I'd say in the last 5 years, there's been a kind of a turbocharge. And this explosion has really related to the types of data the organizations need, the need to interpret a whole range of different types of data. So now we see that there are people who make services and functions and actually whole careers out of analytics, which in those earlier days was less the case. So I feel like it's taken hold in the last, at least from what I've observed in about the last 5 years.
We're seeing the emergence, well, we've long since seen the emergence of the chief data scientist role, haven't we? And this is probably more holistic, but you know, certainly that's testament to the fact that the broader profession of analytics and people analytics is on the rise.
Correct. Yes. And, you know, we have new titles for things. We have official job series from OPM that reflect data science. And so it's really come into its own and been reflected as a serious career that is very technical in nature as well. And so HR is always a combination of qualitative and quantitative skills. But I would say that from a people analytics point of view, this is a future for many people who seek to work in the field of HR. So, and that's different than it was in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. So following on from workforce planning and people analytics, let's talk a little bit more about data-driven decision-making, and especially within that HR function, because you and I have talked about it before. We know how important it is. How have you seen that landscape evolve over your career, and perhaps what do you see as some of the key accelerators to the evolution of data-driven decisions?
Sure. I would say that now as before, what we're really trying to do with data in terms of making decisions is getting to believable so you can actually convince others, and reliable insights from the data. That's really what it's all about. And I know that is the quest that all organizations are really on. So if I look at it from, say, a NASA lens, I mean, we've had data, we're a data-driven organization, so, but we've had data about workforce for a very long time, but it was very much anchored in the patterns, like supply data, on patterns that we knew were reliable. Like we could investigate tweaks and changes and shifts, say as economy changed, does our attrition rate shift, as an example. And we had that down really well, and it was pretty reliable. So people were okay making decisions based on that kind of data. What I see now is there's more data, but we haven't, we're still on the journey to figure out how you take the more data and turn that data into information that is both believable and reliable. And I feel like that's a lot harder than it would seem to be on the surface. And so there are some accelerators. Obviously, when there's a need to have to use more data to make difficult decisions, and there is more data there at your fingertips, then clearly that's an accelerator. Like, how do I figure out how to take these sometimes disparate data sets and figure out across them how really to synthesize enough information that when I want to make a decision or tee up a decision for others to make, that I will actually be able to show that it's reliable and believable. And those two are not always the same thing, because the believability is really more about, do people recognize it? You know, when you're anchored in, oh, I see the patterns, I know the patterns, I've made decisions on those patterns before, it worked for me. And now you're in a situation where you're having to make decisions and you don't necessarily know what those patterns mean or believe that they are yet patterns that will hold, it gets a little harder. So I think that the accelerators are that we actually have, of course, better tools overall in which to synthesize the data and pull out the meaning, especially meaning that might not be evident on the surface of it. So it's not just a lot of data points. It's data where you can show patterns below the surface. And I would say that, you know, the environmental uncertainty continue to grow for some places more than others, but there's a lot going on in the economy today. So I imagine all organizations are faced with, hey, I have a lot that I can look at. What do I look at? And then how do I figure out what it's actually trying to tell me so that I can be smart about what I do or don't do? Mm. So,
Jane, you quite eloquently described the critical thinking capability there, where we look at pulling together seemingly disparate data sources and you know, tell a story from them. That capability stereotypically, historically, maybe sits in functions like engineering, science, mathematicians, you know, perhaps outside, traditionally outside of HR. How have you gone about either identifying that capability from elsewhere and borrowing it, or building it, or even identifying it within the HR function over the years?
So it really is a combination of build and buy. So I feel like with many functions that are like this, where there's a lot of rapid acceleration in the outside world, it's important for any organization to actually pull from the outside, whether that's through a contracting mechanism or whether that's from a hiring point of view. And so we've done some of that. We certainly have some contract mechanisms, and we've hired people from outside at NASA, and we've done some amount of building from within. And the reason that both having a combination of those two things matters is that from a belief, getting to the point where you can believe or really articulate what the needs are, it requires quite a bit more context of the environment of NASA and what the past has said and how that compares to what the data might be showing today, or to find a way to connect the sort of new types of analyses to those that have traditionally been done and really be able to connect our stakeholders in the agency to that data so that it is more believable to them. So it's a combination of really that deep understanding of the environment that you're in and also an ability to be able to pull from some of the more current expertise, ways of thinking, and tools that are available out there so that one doesn't get too insulated from kind of the progress being made externally.
Mm. Yeah. And certainly, I've got a mental note to come back to the environment and context piece because I think that's really critical. Let's talk about the reliance on single data sources versus pulling together information that validates your hypothesis. So how has that emerged? How have you seen that emerge within HR? And how have you tried to sort of foster that across your people analytics function?
So we have allowed for some amount of experimentation. So for instance, skills adjacency is an example of something where, you know, we have kind of more of a testbed environment for figuring out whether we can actually get to some interesting findings and results to then change the thinking about how it is that we will be able to reshape supply as needed that we already have, for example, versus always hiring from the outside. So we've got some of the test beds stuff. And then we also have, you know, taken a look at the platforms and the data sources that we can get through those platforms and tried to figure out how it is that we can add data sources. So it's really not taking away, it's adding. So a good example would be that we know there's a lot going on in the environment. Like, okay, in the past, we know that our attrition rates are between 4 and 7% reliably, and these are the factors that change it from being on the low side to the high side overall, right? Now, we know that there are some things going on in our industry which might shift the attrition rates from those norms that we would have expected. And so we are trying to figure out, well, what external data sources do we need to look at? And we do sort of what we call environmental scanning. So how do we turn that environmental scan into reliable data, and at what level can we do it? So the singular data sources that we've had for forever that are absolutely our authoritative data sources, anything from payroll to forecasting models for attrition or things like that, we are still there and are still valid. But we're really doing this adding, because I believe that the more uncertain the environment and the further out that you are looking, the more you really must take a look at multiple data sources and try to figure out where the connection points are. And so that's really the journey that NASA has been on, NASA Human Capital specifically. But from all my wanderings around outside of NASA, I don't think we are alone. This seems to be a common theme.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's probably a good segue into sort of the notion of context and environment. I'm keen to continue that discussion, but also thinking about the broader data and analytics capability. So, you know, using data to make good decisions is important, but it's not enough in its own right. So what else do we think comprises the effective application of the data and analytics capability from a context and environment perspective?
Sure. Well, so there are a couple of things. One, clearly from an HR practitioner point of view, technology and tools can really help us automate parts of our work that should be automated. And I believe that they will more and more. And the question is, where is the dividing line between that which we think tools and AI can effectively take over what we would have done through people in the past or today, and what it should do in the future. So that is a clear focus for that I, you know, that I had for the human capital function as kind of part of what we were doing when we consolidated it over the last 3 to 5 years. So that's important. I also think that we need to figure out whether there are pieces of work or elements of our service offerings that we can actually make practicable because we can manage large data. So if you think about things like development needs, succession planning, I don't call them career paths, but maybe career growth would be an example. Engagement, organizational health and welfare. I mean, these are all things that are not driven by data necessarily, but which have a data element. And I would say in the past, we were not really able to do significant amounts in some of those higher order qualitative processes, because the sheer volume of data and manual manipulation of it would have not made it practicable for us to do it more than, you know, once in a while and for subsets of our enterprise. And I think we can actually not only do more of those things, but also do them at scale, or at whatever scale is needed, maybe is the perhaps the better way to put that. So to me, there's like this world of opportunity if we can automate some of the things that are linear, sequential, that are anchored in known authoritative data sources, and it's just a matter of making sure there's an accuracy and reliability in what it is that we're doing each step of the process. We can cede some of that to technology and instead turn our attention to how do we take the bigger data, I wouldn't call it big data, but bigger data sets, and then really try to figure out how to create a robust set of insights that can help us as people deliver services that I know to be important, in fact, really critical for the HR function in the future.
I think you've listed some of my all-time favorites there, Jane, as far as tying back to the multiple data sources piece. So things like employee engagement, welfare and well-being, you know, performance data, pathways are all data that perhaps don't necessarily create the beautiful visual time series, you know, stacked column, traditional type data, but we can use them to say, well, we think there's a challenge with, you know, how our leaders are performance scoring, for example. But let's have a look at some of that to see whether it actually is the case or not. So some of my out and out favorites. So I love the way that ties back in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So and you did touch on AI, and we're not going to ignore that elephant in the room. Very, very keen to sort of talk about that as well. When we're in this kind of shifting environment space, we make decisions that take context and environment into account. What then happens? So we're in a dynamic environment, we make a decision. What are some of the important considerations around those decisions to cater for the fact that, you know, we are in a dynamic sort of landscape?
Sure. Yes, and particularly with insights that are newer to us, it's important to really think that through. And I would say, in my head, it's a combination of risk management and being willing to shift and adjust. So in other words, you only take on decisions that you feel that you must make, because if you don't, then you will limit your opportunities down the road away. So for instance, for us, you know, for NASA, if NASA wanted to fundamentally shift the size or mix of the workforce that it has, it would take many years to do that, given how we work. So the decision is, do you do anything to shift it? And if you do, start down a path of shifting it, and it could, that shift could be any kind of shift, right? It could be the mix of the roles. It could be where the roles are. It could be remote versus not remote. It could be a whole bunch of things. But any one of those items or changes to the workforce doesn't just happen overnight. So what are the risks that I run if I do nothing? So that's one.
Yeah.
And secondly, how locked in am I if things change around me? And so what are the steps that feel that I'm not locking myself in, that I can actually change and adjust as I go? And I think that that finding that sweet spot between doing something if there's an environmental shift that's going on, but feeling good about it's the right thing to do given all the signals, but it doesn't lock me in. And I think I mentioned to you once a long while back that someone wise once told me that the debate in workforce planning is it the plan or is it the ability to plan? Or more important, the data, which is really the ability to plan.
Yeah.
And so there were people on both ends, and I think it's really both. I mean, I think one has to plan for things that you pretty much know, especially in the short term, and then you have to be willing to execute some things to set yourselves up as an organization for the longer run, but have good information flowing in along the way so that you can kind of adjust course.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that that's something that the strategic workforce planning community can and has, to be fair, embraced. And it's almost the plan is a beacon, isn't it? It's a North Star. I mean, how have your workforce planners had to embrace or wrestle with the concept of perhaps what we plan now isn't what's going to eventuate, and more than likely isn't?
Yes. Well, so I think what we know is that we have to run a bunch of scenarios about what the future could hold. I think so. It's a combination of scanning the environment for what's going on that I could actually see with my eyes today, yes. As well as sort of figuring out what the scenarios could look like in the future if X happens or Y happens or Z happens, and then distilling from that, what does this mean? Where am I investing, for example? What kinds of skills do I need to invest in? So I think the other part of planning for workforce in a volatile environment is you can't plan 100%. You know, I think back almost with a chuckle about the way the government used to talk about workforce planning. You have a plan for everyone. I need this. I have this. This minus this is what I need to do in terms of, you know, more or less, or, you know, retraining or whatever. And while that simple formula is still in its own way, good basic foundation, it's way more complicated than that. And I feel like not every field or job series or type of function is changing at the same rate. And so, and when you have a reliable turnover rate, when you have a reliable sources for replenishment, those things are inherently less risky maybe for those functions. So the focus needs to be on the subset of things where there are more unknowns, where where they're more leveraged, meaning that the opportunities that you will be able to realize by having a skill is greater than perhaps in other areas, or where you need to learn and adapt other things in your organization by having some of that in-house. So figuring out what that subset is that's going to make the biggest difference and where acting sooner rather than later matters, I think that's really where I've seen a shift, not only in what we talked about at NASA, but also across the federal government and outside. So
it's It's almost this concept of, you know, X never ever marks the spot, isn't it? And interestingly, as we've seen people analytics, talent intelligence, these sort of fields mature and become much more laser-like, you know, products out there can use AI to tell you where the talent is emerging, theoretically anyway. Yet that accuracy and that laser-like importance is increasing. From a strategic workforce planning point of view, the wedded concept of this will be the absolute sort of blueprint versus this is probably more directional guidance and we understand it'll shift. It's funny how as we get more accurate, we almost get less accurate in the workforce planning space.
It's absolutely true because it's more complex in the workforce planning space. You know, that original formula is beautiful in its simplicity and it feels really good. The unfortunate part is when you try to do it, it sort of becomes obsolete the following day.
Yeah.
So you have to deal with that additional complexity and deal with those uncertainties, which is where, you know, kind of that the judgment around, well, what do I really have to do? What are the consequences of doing or not doing? And if I can wait for the data that comes in to be more reliable and still be okay, then that works. But when there is a lead time, then you actually have to be able to jump and make some decisions before you know with absolute certainty that the patterns are going to hold. So a lot of new patterns emerging and what do I do with them? And, you know, what does it mean for us? And can I really trust that? So,
yeah, absolutely. Speaking of trust, let's talk about AI.
Oh, yes.
So where do you see the injection of AI into data-driven decision-making at the moment and where do you feel it's headed in the coming years?
This is a fascinating topic, and I don't know that I can prognosticate where it will be even a year or two from now because it is just unfolding so rapidly. It's almost scary. But I see that there is sort of the AI data and insights, and then there's the human decision making, and I think there's still a difference between the two. I mean, we read a lot about, you know, there's inherent bias that the data that's used by AI that gets replicated, for an example. So I feel that it is our duty as executives and managers of organizations to be very aware of where there might be some risks in relying on AI and doing that kind of sanity check based upon the context of how that data might get used. That is true today. I think, for instance, there's smart automation, which, you know, which puts control more in the hands of the end user, right? I don't think that's inherently risky. And then as you move into the qualitative decision making, I think there's a lot that can be provided through AI that would be well beyond what automation it alone can do. And the question is, where is that point in the process where there's a human intelligence that takes a look at what has been synthesized and bounces it against what we as humans can only know about the environment, about the trustworthiness, about other things going on that might not have been included, and so on and so forth. So I still think there is now, and hopefully will forever be, that point where humans come in. I will also say that we're not at the point where we're ceding the governance and responsibility for decisions to, you know, to our tools, right? We need to make sure that we are always responsible for the decisions that get made, and as such have to understand how they were formed. And so that's another reason why I think there just has to be this connection point before the ownership transfers from what, you know, machine learning and AI can provide and what we actually use to change the lives of the people in our organization or change the trajectory of our organizations themselves. So
we've focused on data-driven decisions, and what you've just uncovered is the human element of decision making. So how important are feelings and emotional responses and those sort of intangibles in the decision-making process, looking at a data set and saying, yeah, but it doesn't feel right, or it feels like, you know, A, B, C, and D versus this is exactly what it's telling us on paper?
So there are really, I think there's a benefit and a risk to the feelings. On the one hand, you know, we could see that a conclusion reached by AI doesn't feel right, but it might not feel right because we have, you know, been allowing certain ways of doing things that don't actually live up to exactly what we want. So it can uncover our own patterns of thinking, biases, if you will, in some cases, but more patterns of thinking, and allow us to look at them straight on and say, is that what we actually want? And if not, why not? And are those things legitimate? It can also uncover things that have perhaps been patterns that we didn't actually recognize before, or give us ideas for how things could work that we never thought of. So I actually think the synthesis of if I look at something and I don't like it and it doesn't feel good, it's the next level of questioning around why doesn't it feel good? And it doesn't mean that it's always wrong, right? Mm-hmm. It's really examining what it is that's leading us. And maybe some of it is in the context of how we operate as an organization, that will never work. Right? Just never. Yes. And I know from this evidence and this evidence and this evidence. And that is where some of the value of the ownership and the management from humans lies in this whole decision-making using data process. But let us not allow that kind of idea of ownership and governance to lead us to, you know, ignoring or discounting what we see. And, you know, we've got to continually learn from what that is telling us about why did it create a result that looked like that? And what does that say about us? And so that we actually we have better knowledge of ourselves. Think about it. You know, that's easier to do with a small organization. It gets harder and harder the bigger an organization is. And so, to my mind, this is more of a conversation about what happens across much larger organizations, be there an entire enterprise or large components within an enterprise, to really get what's happening and learn from it. So,
how do you feel the HR community can better engage with and leverage the incredible wave of emerging tech that's happening at the moment? What do you think are the key points?
So I think HR is in this position where they are having to adapt to different work and different ways of doing work. So if I look at, say, our HR business partners as an example, and many organizations have this as a model for client service. So our HR business partners at NASA have typically done a range of consulting, but also really supporting service delivery. And it's a human-delivered service in a lot of what we do. And so there's an opportunity to examine what doesn't have to be a human-provided service any longer. So there's a letting go part of this, which I actually think is hard. Mm. because, you know, we are at NASA, it's very customer service oriented. And so we want to be able to do anything that we're asked and do the whole range of have touch points for the whole range of services that are offered from human capital to the organizations in order to feel that we have complete ownership and are able to over deliver on what our customers want. So the letting go part is really hard. At the same time, there's this pivot to spending more time doing things that are consulting oriented, like some of the things I mentioned earlier, like succession planning might be a good example of that, right? How do you leverage the data to really not only do what is asked and what is sort of defined in the service delivery model, but how do we get proactive? Mm. How do we flag things that are going on and be able to investigate them enough to be able to come to our customers and say, this is what we see, this is what we should do, this is why, and really gets the buy-in from the customers based upon that sort of ability to really synthesize the data and tell stories from it. So I do think the HRBP model is shifting. It's not that it has had none of this and all of this, but it's shifting the mix of what our HRBPs would do and our field center operations would do, and really pivoting it to more of that kind of service. And I would say, we haven't touched on storytelling, but I actually think for anyone, whether they're in HR or anywhere else, the ability to tell stories with data in an intelligible way that is compelling is a skill in and of itself. And not everyone has it. And it's something that one can learn and get much better at with experience, but it takes intent to do it. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those, I'd almost call it a capability. And we know that we're not going to draw hard lines, but they're much more difficult to gain than skills. Yeah, you know, they're more innate. Yeah, they're more to do with your sort of underlying abilities. But I'm glad that you sort of flagged that it can be grown and expanded and to a degree acquired. Super important. So through this, we'll see tech provide a platform or an opportunity, do you think, for HR to become more strategic and hopefully let go of a lot of the traditional spot fire problem solving that almost they've been forced into due to environmental circumstances?
Very much so. And I would apply it equally to the quantitative, you know, linear sequential processes that we have as I would to the qualitative, more consulting processes. I think it has an impact. Technology and data has an impact on both. And so we're really at a lucky place as a country or a world in having as many tools and platforms and visualization tools as we have. So I think that once we can let go of a lot of the effort in those more consultative data-driven areas moves from manipulating data, right? Collecting, sanitizing, and manipulating data and into really figuring out what all the pieces, parts are saying, and then figuring out how to shape a story around it. So,
absolutely. If I was a HR business partner, for example, and either I want to do that, or I'm seeing an emerging trend that says, you know, using data to tell a story, critical thinking capability, data analytics are the way of the future. What would be sort of one or two things I could do to help start that journey around shifting those capabilities?
Well, I would consider it a sort of going back to being a student again, which I think everyone needs to think that they're a student. They're a practitioner, they're an expert, but they're also a student. So go back to being a student and really get out there and listen and learn. And then I think there is a lot of value in taking the time to really create products, to experiment and to practice. And it, surprisingly, it sounds like, well, that's a waste of time. It really isn't. Mm-hmm. And so there's nothing to be lost in actually stepping forward and taking a bit of a risk, put together, you know, a finding and, you know, check it with your colleagues and your manager and then move it out to your customer and see where it lands. Be inventive, you know, figure out what, if there's a need, maybe there's a different way to go about solving a customer need than you would traditionally do. So say sort of take that pause and say, okay, normally what I would do is I would ask for this and this and this, and then I come back to the customer and I deliver a practical response and then we do something, it would go away. Okay, well, how about I know there's this other thing going on in another set of data that we have access to. Let me build that in. And so it's little things like that, little baby steps that can sometimes get a lot of learning in a short spurt and also build confidence along the way. Because I think that's part of it, is it's lack of experience and confidence when that hasn't been your world for, you know, a good part of a career. And so that's what I would do. Be a student and then be willing to experiment safely and with support from the folks around. Go do a detail assignment. Details are like rotational assignments. You know, go somewhere new for 6 months and work with someone who's really good at that stuff and learn that way. So again, sort of a combination of applied training on the job to supplement just sort of the idea of being a student and listening.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think the onus is on the leaders and employers also to identify curiosity, that trait. Yes. And we've gone from skills to capabilities to traits now, which is hard to capture, hard to bottle, but if we can identify those curious mindsets and nurture them in that way, then that's a huge start as well, I think.
Absolutely. It's definitely, you set the environment to allow for that, and then you let people feel safe in trying new things and experimenting. And so you're looking for people who want to experiment, but you're also setting an environment that makes it feel safe and acceptable and, in fact, almost desired. And so I would agree that that's incredibly important for an organization, is to make sure that you've got the raw materials but in the people, but you also are kind of setting, I don't know if it's an expectation, but it's direct encouragement.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, Jane, I'm really looking forward to your upcoming session at People Analytics World in April. A bit of a different role for me, given the dynamic that we've had.
Absolutely, yes.
But certainly different in an enjoyable way. I get to sit back and just really, really sort of actively listen and watch the dynamic play out. So I can't wait for that. I'm not going to say goodbye because this is certainly not the end of our personal journey and personal friendship, but certainly in terms of knowing you as the Chief Human Resources Officer of NASA, I want to thank you so much for how generous you've been with your time for conferences, podcasts, meetings, sessions over the years. I've adored every minute of it. And I look forward to collaborating and your friendship in the years to come.
Same here, Nick. I've really enjoyed all the sessions that we've done together. It's really been fun having a dialogue with you. It doesn't feel like it's sort of a ball that's bouncing back and forth. It's more that we are actually looking at the future together, and that's really been fun. And I too have enjoyed every minute of it and hope to continue along the journey of making HR the function it deserves to be everywhere in the world, and continuing to watch as things evolve around us, as they most certainly will. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Thanks, Jane.
Thanks so much, Nick. See you at the conference.
See you there.